thank you so much for joining us today. I'm really excited to welcome you to our Calling Hours podcast. For our listeners, we are in the middle of a series featuring different funeral home owners throughout the country. So we've had some really interesting conversations in this series, and I'm really excited for today's guest because we have Brian Joseph with us, who's the owner and chairman of Verheiden Funeral Homes in Detroit. Brian, thank you for being here. I'm so glad to welcome you.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for the invitation, Danielle.
Well, I want to start by talking about how you found your way to funeral service. You're a first-generation funeral director, and that's not common in this space. A lot of times it's a generational thing, it's a family thing. Talk to me a little bit about how you found your way into funeral service and how you made your way to Verheiden.
Wow. Well, let's go back. At age 15, my classmate lived behind a funeral home, and we worked and played wiffle ball in the basement of the funeral home that he lived behind. Then one day, they asked us to move flowers. And then they said, can you help clean up or pull weeds and wash cars and work around the floor? And can you ever put a sport coat on? And all of a sudden, I began to like that at such a young age. And then one day came out of the blue and they asked us, hey, can you go on this transfer and help with the lift of this heavy person at the hospital? Yeah, sure. You're young and bold and we're going to do that. But I got it began to come natural to me. It began to resonate that we're helping someone that needed some help. And I was young at that point in time. I come from a very simple middle-class family. And I know at age 40, my father had a massive stroke and didn't really work another day in his life. And my mother worked very tirelessly to make sure that myself and my brother and my sister just had an education. But knowing that I liked this in the industry, I began to go out and hunt other funeral homes and say, you know, let me see if I can put my application here and work here part-time. Because I was 15. I was still kind of working my way into that little area of...
You were a baby.
Oh, yeah, I was. I enjoyed it. But you know what? Then in the early 1980s, I landed this part-time job at Verheiden's. And I worked there. I slept at another funeral home, answer phones at night. I went to high school. I went to college. Continued to go to mortuary school. Graduated in 1986, accepted a position in 1986-87 there at Verheiden as a full-time licensee. And that's kind of where I started. That's how I kind of walked into Verheiden itself.
You mentioned that you kind of worked at a few different funeral homes. What was it about Verheiden that made you want to stay?
That's a great question because the one I worked at before was a lower volume firm. And I had that energy and that call it the piss and vinegar to move and to be active. And the one owner was, I look back at it, was very complacent. And I wanted more. I wanted to understand more. I was almost like the human sponge. And I saw funeral service way back then as, you know, it was a pipe. It was in one way out the other. And each day that grew to me, I looked at it in a way that said, wow, Verheiden, I can see something different. And I was making less money at Verheiden. What I was offered from the lower volume firm. So it really wasn't about money. It was about the opportunity.
Yeah. So what was Verheiden's business structure like when you joined it? Did they have just the one location or was it several different?
It was one. It was one location there in Grosse Pointe Park. Mr. Verheiden, he died in 1986. And his first transition of the business went to the seven directors that were with him his entire life from anywhere from 25 years to 58 years. Not a single individual had an individual majority ownership. They were all individual owners, but the business itself was so unique because of the fact that it handled the wealthiest to the poorest of individuals. And it was a higher volume firm that kind of gave me that ability to learn. To understand a little bit more about it than just a smaller volume firm at the time.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're talking about seven different directors in leadership at that funeral home. That's seven different people with seven different experiences and seven times the stories of families they've served that you can learn from. I can understand someone who's curious and hungry and ambitious wanting to stay and learn from that group.
Mr. Verheiden, he personally taught those individuals that were with him his entire career. And there had to be a draw that kept them there. And each of those seven directors or owners at the time then, after his death, they were highly regarded within the industry. They were teachers at the mortuary school. They were the masters of restorative arts. They were leaders in all different facets of that business. And that's where I used a scenario. That's where it started with the diamond. Mm-hmm. Because I had a look at this diamond that said, wow, if it's preparation or if it's at need or it's pre-need, and we're on the cusp of the aspect of the aftercare side of it as it began to come into play. And what was really unique, we had women on staff that were not clerical, that were not housekeeping. We had the grief counselor. We had an apprentice. We had the ability that women were slowly integrated into the vision of that operation. And that's in the early 80s.
Yeah. And I think some of our younger listeners may not appreciate that. I grew up in a funeral home in the 90s in a conservative small town in Iowa. And my mom was on staff. And I remember hearing difficult conversations between my dad and my mom of whether she can push a casket down to the front of the church, whether she can be visibly seen as greeting people at the visitation, if she needed to wear a skirt with pantyhose, or if it was okay for her to wear a pantsuit. Like, I think that sometimes we take for granted that the reality in funeral service today for women alongside men is what it's always been, and hasn't. That is unique. In the 80s, to have women in different roles outside of receptionist, that was big. That was progressive.
In 1992, when I actually took on the general manager's role, there was an article that the local newspaper did on Verheiden that they realized of our 9 licensees that we had on staff, 6 were female.
Hmm.
And it changed the whole face into that part of the industry where we became more receptive. We embraced it. Because at the end of the day, I don't care how you cut it, women have the most innate ability to honor, to care. And that in and of itself, to me, is a MasterCard commercial. Don't get me wrong. There are some men that are very good at it, but it comes innately to women. And I think that's a very important piece of the equation of what kind of led into our changes and our successes.
Well, and I think you're right that the women in the funeral space bring a different perspective, a different type of skill set, just broaden the conversation. And I love hearing you talk about it in terms of the staffing, because I think it's also reflected in the families that you serve. I've heard you talk about Verheiden as a United Nations funeral home, someone that opens their doors and serves all kinds of communities. And so it's not surprising to me that that diversity is reflected in your staff as well.
When you add the 7 owners, you got to also understand there were 7 spouses on top of it. So there are 14.
Yeah. Yeah. You, small business owners, it's always it's a couple.
No, like, disrespect to all those owners out there with owners and spouses. Yeah, I get it. Mm-hmm. But there's all personalities and there's all the dynamics that are involved with it.
You mentioned that when you joined Verheiden, they had the one location at Grosse Pointe. I've been to that location. It is beautiful, but the business has grown since then. You've expanded into many different locations. And throughout that time, you kind of transitioned from being, the 15-year-old baby in funeral service to now owner and chairman of a very big, very important business. Talk to me a little bit about kind of the transitions that you've gone through in your time at Verheiden.
As I said before, that opportunity came to me in the stronger leadership part of the company in 1989, where my primary focus was to create truly the variety of treasury stock buyouts for those 7 original owners. That part of the transition was extremely important because of the fact that they all grew old to Mr. Verheiden. Mr. Verheiden, 96, 97 years of age. These original 7 were as high as 75 to 58 years of age, all looking towards that retirement side of it. But that opportunity began to present itself. And then, you move into the point of where do we go from here to expand the opportunity of the funeral home? But I looked at it in a way that we made an acquisition in 1995 where we acquired a location, which was the location I started at.
And the funeral home that you... And the sleepier funeral home with the lower cost. I didn't know that bit of trivia.
Not many people do.
That is fascinating.
Yeah, it really is. And but at the end of the day, we also made an acquisition with just property that we have currently and that we never built on just because of the way the business was forming. But it gave us the ability to kind of expand out But by doing that, it kind of led into having key advice from trusted advisors that what do we really do? How do we really do this? What should we be doing? And the focus when we began to make these acquisitions and began to change the face of Verheiden, we focused on the individual needs and the wants of those transitioning their interest. That was really important to us. And it was important that not just the, remember, seven directors and their seven spouses, it was also during that transition of their treasury stock buyouts, we also looked at the aspect, what would anybody else want in their transition period? So we focused, I mean, some of the areas that we look at is, do we focus on their price? Do we focus on what their needs are? And we evaluate that.
Yeah. I've heard Chris at Foresight talk a lot about, Chris Krueger talk a lot about trying to figure out what is the most important in an ownership transition. And a lot of times the owner cares about the money because it's their livelihood, it's their retirement, it's their nest egg. But there's something else that is even more important. And a lot of times the company that acquires a funeral home isn't necessarily the one that can pay the most money. It's the one that meets those critical needs. So I think it makes sense that you were asking those questions of those directors as you're kind of transitioning and buying out their partnership. Do you have advice, I mean, for others who are looking to make an ownership transition?
Yeah, I do. Matter of fact,
I'm not surprised.
I'll take that next step farther from your dialogue is that we always focused on when we talk to, if we're going to grow or if somebody asks me or calls me or talks to me, there are six things we focused on. And it's these six items were the six items that were the key focus on the original seven owners. For example, yes, we wanted to focus on their needs and their wants and transitioning their interests. That was key. Some may focused on price and you would have to evaluate the terms. Others may focus on specific terms and then we have to consider that price. There may be some that in that mix of us, it's not about the money, as you said. It's about carrying on the heritage and the legacy. Some just wanted freedom.
Time.
And the key, what I say to anyone that kind of speaks to me, or if we're into a future part of acquisition, the goal is to keep an open mind and listen with your eyes and your heart to help those get what they need. And then you yourself have nothing to worry about.
I mean, it's not that different than sitting across from a family in an arrangement conference and being able to read the room, read the needs, and get to a place where they're comfortable, you're comfortable, everyone feels confident that you're designing a meaningful service. Those skills translate, I would think, really easily into what you're talking about.
You've heard many people say, in one ear, out the other.
Yes, my children practice that daily.
Well, I'm not going to comment. but I will say, in those six items I just read to you, we don't listen with our ears. Mm-mm. No, don't get too caught up with the hearing what you want to hear and translate it to your brain. Your eyes and your heart will tell you exactly what they need and what they want. And it's your goal to figure out the way. And if you're solution driven enough, how it all works.
Yeah.
So
I think your story is really remarkable, kind of starting out in funeral service as, you know, a little young whippersnapper and kind of working your way up through into ownership and then growing the business into what it is today with, you know, beautiful locations serving hundreds of families. And I know I've heard you talk about during the COVID years, Detroit was hit really hard during COVID and you guys were serving so many families. And kind of really the pinnacle of your success, only to face some pretty significant challenges shortly thereafter. Do you want to talk a little bit about that time period and what was happening?
Yeah, you know what? When I reflect on answering that question, I really can't begin to say, what did it start at the COVID years? I look at those, what are the hardest moments? My son says to me that, he says, hey, Dad, anything you touch is great. It always works out. I said, Aaron, you don't know the items that I couldn't make happen because I don't dwell on that. But those harder moments, you know what? Dealing with the first 14 owners, wow. Hello.
You learned a lot.
Hey, I was 26 years of age. I had some good advisors back and forth, but it was like, when that first owner said, "Brian, you're full of piss and vinegar," well, that kept on flowing. But
yeah,
the growing pain after that, okay, we got through it. And then there was growing pains with that first acquisition, the second location. Then with the multiple locations, operations became a little bit easier. But then we began to change the face of our operations to demonstrate to the communities that we are a multicultural organization that embraces multicultural communities with Mr. Verheiden's motto in mind, Danielle, knowing that even today, if you look at, I don't care if it's our website, wherever, you'll see our crest. You'll see the crest of 1908 of Mr. Verheiden. On the bottom of that crest is written in Latin. Those who want to understand Latin translated to English, you want to talk about visionary Mr. Verheiden, Danielle, in full circle? That translates real simple. The same, always to all.
I love that.
To 2025 and beyond. So that began to resonate. So those harder moments, as we began to make that change, we began to embrace it. Then, yes, the COVID years, the next harder moments. The pre-COVID business ramped up. Expectations unimaginable. Everybody in the industry was feeling it. No help. We're getting bodies. What's going on over here? Everybody's on this big pinnacle of growing. Then the COVID year. Not the year, but the COVID year. The massive employee reductions with even higher call volume. Daunting to our active team members on separating. Yeah. Who can do what? Who can't do what? Those. And I will say, with the massive reductions in staff, we served over 970 COVID cases when a lot of funeral homes in Detroit said no. We did one thing that I firmly believe, even to this day, was a success that no one in our organization caught COVID from any of the bodies coming in. We really didn't allow anybody to go in the refrigerations to come in. Well, what happened was this. We knew science. Everybody that came into our garage, underground garage, as you've seen, you can visualize.
Yeah, all of your preparation work is done out of the Grosse Pointe location. You've got that beautiful facility. So you've got it centralized, so you have some control over that.
Though before the human remains were taken out of that vehicle, there was a headgear put on, and that we knew there were 7 orifices that something could get out, right? Mm-hmm. So then we in turn went to the preparation room. Everybody was embalmed, regardless, because we knew the disinfection was there.
Yeah.
Remains placed in an isolation area. We did this consistently. Then we made arrangements. We went online. And I mean, one of the greatest things that was the benefit for us as we first entered in it was e-funeral. It gave us the ability. We were doing this as a test model, and that program helped us better than any Zoom call or Zoom arrangements or any of that nature, only because it had that ability to dialogue with people remotely.
Yeah, so I mean, you're not alone in that. We had a ton of funeral homes that were using eFuneral for pre-need. And in COVID, they found out that it was so tremendously helpful for the at-need side as well, because they didn't have to have that face-to-face interface.
Right. It truly worked out well. In the end, that gave us a little bit of relief in trying to meet with people and talk with people. Then the next kind of hard moment was that post-COVID year. Let's not all forget about that. Remember, too many died too early. All the business trends across our space of funeral service, it changed. Our financial business changed. Our sales expectations changed. But the expenses were still there, right?
Yeah, your fixed costs don't change. And if if you don't have families to serve, you still have to cover those costs.
No question. And that really created another issue for us coming out of those COVID years. Then, number 5, those hard moments, because I got 6 hard moments, and they're real simple. Number 5
is 6. You are blessed.
6. That's what I mean. I was going back and forth. I mean, everything else we can try to address, but these 6 are all challenging in our world, and it ramps up because number 5 goes real simple. Look what happened to the economy, the interest rates. All of us that have those SBA loans, Danielle, we had 10.5% interest rates on these notes. It was like, whoa, whatever happened to 4%?
Yeah.
So all those items really began to have a challenge coming off that post-COVID year. And then we go into 2022. It goes into, as I call it, the Detroit flood. Now, you heard me talk about the minority shareholder buyouts, or those treasury stock buyouts, right?
Yeah.
The Detroit flood program that affected us so adversely, it made the 14 owner treasury stock buyouts a walk in the park.
Talk to me about what happened in 2022. I know the story, but our listeners don't. So tell them what happened in those few months.
2022, in the month of June, Detroit had a massive rainstorm and knew it was coming. And it was proven now through the courts that the individuals at the, and I'll say the Great Lakes Water Authority in Detroit, forgot to flip on the switches to push the water out to the river. That's the cliff notes of it. They fell asleep. What did that do to Verheiden? I'll tell you what it did to Verheiden. We had two locations, our Grosse Pointe Park location, our Southwest Detroit location. When people see the news clips on the reel of the Detroit expressways, the funny thing is, water, that's the exit where our funeral home is at, which was less than 1,000 feet away. Both of our locations, imagine, you visited the Grosse Pointe Park location. Those who are listening, go to verheiden.org. Look at the picture of the Grosse Pointe location. Look at the 36,000 square feet. Look at the canopies on the outside of the building. That's the size of the basement. Danielle, I'm not sure if you're 5 feet or not, but if you're 5 foot.
How dare you? I am 5'5", sir. Okay. I'm sure, but not that
you
short.
You know what? That's great.
I think we figured this out. My nose would have just been above the water.
We had 5 feet of water throughout the entire basement.
Mm-hmm.
The entire basement, just there.
And that's where you do body preparation for all of the families you serve.
14 vehicles in the basement. We have, you name it, everything that supports the operation is in the underground. That's the vision of Mr. Verheiden.
Well, and I remember you telling me that this happened on a day when you guys had a funeral. And so you just happened to be at the location to get a vehicle. And there was just water everywhere. You're trying to drive.
It rained Friday night. I'm on my way there and I'm getting calls that we can't get to the basement. We have vehicles down there and they're all supposed to go out. Bottom line is, you know what? I started walking down in the sewage.
And probably not the best choice, given that there's floating. Electrical down there.
There's everything. Oh, yeah, of course there is. It's all floating. There's stuff. I'm saying to myself, okay, let's get these cars out of here because someone's got to go down there. Started one hearse. I got it started. I drove slowly. You should see the waves going. Then I got the next hearse out. Came back down there. And the blue, I mean, we got the cars out. They started.
Mm-hmm.
And I told the staff, do not turn them off.
Yep, just keep them running.
Go to the funerals. Go. We called a couple friends of ours, other funeral director friends. Say, hey, listen, if you have a hearse available, just on standby, can we just do that? Or vehicles? And we had a lot of good colleagues that found out what happened to us. They kind of just jumped in and said, if you need a vehicle, that's fine. We'll do it. But at the end of the day, the water's still there. And we had these other pumps, big pumps that we went up to our attic and big water hoses. And just, we always plan. You never know, right? Occasionally there's a little flood here and there because we have a big sewer system there. Never 5 feet. Sure. If a sump pump busted, okay, you're going to get maybe 6 inches of water or whatever's going to, we got to get that out of there, right? Or the sewer goes and it goes back down. But this was beyond devastating. This was catastrophic.
Mm-hmm.
This is just the Grosse Pointe location, not to mention the Detroit location. Then after this gets rebuilt, we began to rebuild this. And sure, we're filing the insurance claim. We're arguing with the insurance company back and forth. We estimated over $2 million in damages. I'm talking elevators, preparation facilities, chairs, you name it. You walk that area. Anything that you can physically see that supports the operation of a funeral home.
Mm-hmm.
After that part of it, we got a whopping $25,000 for each location from our insurance company. It was certainly a challenge because in the end, Great Lakes Water Authority and the City of Detroit said, governmental immunity.
So you didn't get anything from...
Shut the front door. Government immunity? No way. And we were really the only business. Now, the entire part of Grosse Pointe Park and the areas of Detroit saturated, flooded. Yeah, we joined this class action lawsuit. We went in and tried to get the money. Circuit court said, nope, governmental immunity, they win. Then finally, after the Court of Appeals, just 2 weeks ago, they overturned it.
Mm.
And the attorneys called and said, do you have the receipts? I said, you bet your sweet rear end we have.
I have receipts.
You're talking to someone that I have the detail.
Yeah. So,
but at the end of the day, we had to rebuild.
Yeah. And you couldn't wait for it to progress through the courts. So you're having to figure out financing. I mean, I'm assuming you just walk into your local bank and they're like, here's a check right away, right? That's super easy. That was your experience?
Well, it was kind of. we talked to our bank what happened. And they said, okay, we'll do another $500,000 loan for you. Has to be an SBA loan. These interest rates are going there. I'm thinking, okay, let's just kind of get a Band-Aid on this thing going here.
Yeah, you don't have a choice. You've got
nobody, Danielle, no one in the community, our families were unserved. They have no clue what was happening here. None, because this is all behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can talk about rebuilding the Detroit location. And after we rebuilt it, then it had two water main breaks next to our facility.
I know, we don't have time to even touch on those. Bad luck. Like you had, and so much financial strain on a business that was positioned very strong before these catastrophic events. And you're trying to get financing. It sounds like you go to your local bank. I think you went to a few other banks and you just kept hearing what?
Well, we had heard no. After we went to our first, our main bank, say what happened. Okay, we'll give you a little bit. Then they said, okay, spigot's off. We can't do it anymore. And I'm trying to show them a picture after that first freeze that our basement of the funeral home, that water from the sewer upheaved the concrete. We couldn't move vehicles there. We needed to repair this. No more money. Couldn't get anything. We're coming off of trying to do paycheck to paycheck, paycheck to paycheck, and work through this, thinking, okay, when our bank said, no more loans, you're on your own, start selling off. I go, whoa, 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 whoa. You want me to sell the company? Because you're not going to give me a loan? No, no, no. I began the work to do the due diligence to start finding the loans. Now, that comes off of 3 devastating years of a $950,000 loss, a $750,000 loss, yes, a $450,000 loss.
And all of this stemming from the first flood and then the events that followed.
It is all compounding.
It's all against a business that up until that point was very profitable and very successful.
No question about it. If I was batting in the World Series today or one of the playoffs, I'd be 0-8.
0-8.
Each bank that we'd go to, send the application in and kind of put it in there and send us your financials. Okay. And I would say it with a little note, can you at least have a conversation and talk about it? And then it got to a point where, well, no, thank you. We really don't want to have a conversation about this right now. We can talk about it more later. I said, all right, well, next. And as I continue to go through that and kind of talk to people about it, it kind of moved into a no, another no, inconsistent no's.
Yeah.
And how were we going to dig out of this massive hole? And I call it a massive hole.
And what did that continued rejection feel like as an owner who has staff to support that you care about, families you want to serve, financially, you want to keep this business, you don't want to sell. Like, what does it feel like to keep hearing, no, no, we can't help you?
You know, it was hurtful. I'm not going to deny that. It was challenging. But the one thing, as I said, trying to get the digging out of this process and to try to find the right mix was a challenge. And until it all comes down to, a friend of mine who was an advisor said that, hey, have you ever talked to Teresa Carlson? And I said, no, who's she? And he goes, she's at Bancorp. Give her a call. So I had a quick little phone call. And again, can you just send the stuff over, fill out the application? I'm going, okay, here we go. Here's 049. Here it comes. So I sent it over, and 3 days later, comes out of nowhere, and she says, can we talk about this? And I said, you mean you really want to have a conversation?
You want to know more?
Did you look at everything? Yeah, I did. I looked at it all. Can we talk about it? Yeah. Like when? Now?
I'm available anytime. Anytime you want to talk.
I never gave up hope. And I said to myself, there's one. Somebody else out there will believe in Verheiden. Somebody will realize and do a little bit of work and research. And then one of the questions she says, Brian, is there any like news articles or anything about this flood? I said, oh yeah, well, hang on. What's your email?
I got a special folder of them on my computer just for this moment.
She says, you know, you just can't make this up. I go, no, you can't. You really cannot. I said, you want to see the lawsuit? I mean, I'm reading off things like it's really quick. She says, no. We're not even there. Let's talk about how this all happened. And Teresa and the West Coast, because this is not a normal loan.
Yeah. Okay.
You're looking at Verheiden on paper, and you're looking at three sets of tax returns and financial statements. As I'm openly saying, $950,000 loss, almost $1 million. $700,000+, $400,000+. Friend of mine in funeral service said that, he said, Brian, most people would have sold their businesses by now. You should be funeral director of the year. I said, oh yeah, okay, great. Sure, whatever.
I'm going to just go ahead and give you one right now. When we first started talking about your entry into funeral service, you talked about how you were just inherently curious and you wanted to know more. And I think it strikes me as fitting that the person who finally was able to help you approached it with that same kind of curiosity. Let's talk about this. Tell me more about what happened. Like, it kind of feels like you met kind of someone that it was like you and had that insatiable curiosity that wanted to hear more about the Verheiden before the flood. And that's what you really needed. You needed someone to ask that question.
Yes. I live it. And sometimes I'm immune to it because of the organization. And Teresa wanted to see not just that scope of 3 years. She wanted to see, what did Verheiden look like before this even happened? What can Verheiden look like after this?
Mm-hmm.
And that became, if you can think of it as a funnel, what was happening to us before was the bottom of the funnel. I work well on analogies, but I can tell you what Teresa did is she created the new lip of the funnel. What I do and what we talk to our staff about making funeral arrangements, when someone is very much confused in emotions and everything is flying for the death, all these circles are flying around. Our goal for each of our families when we're done is to make those circles look like the Olympic rings. And Danielle, I was one that had more circles flying than the law allows.
Yeah.
And if I had to say the one thing, what Teresa did, not only did she expand the funnel because it wasn't narrow again, she made all those concerns put together the Olympic ring program for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in the end, is beyond the MasterCard commercial. That was priceless. Not just to me professionally, not just to me personally, or spiritually, or emotionally, or physically, or psychologically, she created the roadmap.
Yeah.
And the roadmap, without her really knowing who I was, when that 15-year-old kid got involved in funeral service, and I just said, well, tell me what you want me to do. Tell me what you want me to do. And I give the analogy that we were truly in the Kuwait desert through that desert storm. But we know there was two sets of footprints out, and I knew that. There was one of General Schwarzkopf that made his way out. We don't know if the Iraqi soldier made his way out of that desert.
Mm-hmm.
But if I followed the footsteps that were laid out to me, I didn't care how high or how low or what we had to do, we followed it. But the key was, as she introduced this whole thing to us, our staff knew we had a deep, deep hole, None of our families knew about it.
Yeah.
The only thing I could give to our staff was the hope and the leadership for a brighter tomorrow. And they all knew. And you can see our staff from the website. And you can see almost 4 of our 5 managers at locations are women today. They knew everyone had to come to work as income producers and expense reducers. We needed to figure out every dime that needed to help justify the changes of these debts until we can find a new and brighter tomorrow. And we did.
Mm-hmm.
But the staff in and of itself, they knew it. Not only did we have to climb out of this hole, they had a mountain to climb after that. And 1 year into the new mortgage, everybody sees it. That's that history of what we did to dig out. So, I mean, I applaud our staff. It wasn't just me. I mean, I can give them hope. I can give them leadership. But there was no way Charles Rehine Inc. was going to end its legacy because of a bunch of water that hit us.
I mean, that's the good work of funeral service is figuring it out behind the scenes in a way that makes for a good, solid business so that you're there to serve the families in a way that the family never experiences it. And I love hearing you talk about this because I know you, I've met some of your staff, and I've heard about your business from Teresa. I've heard about it from Steve Schaefer, that they have confidence that you did everything right going into the flood. And then once the flood hit, everything you could to dig out on your own. And when that was not enough, there was Teresa and there was Homesteaders and there was our funeral home lending program to give you a life preserver, to take those payments. I can't remember what you said, if it went down by 30% or 50%, your monthly payments, to give you the breathing room you needed so that you and your staff could continue to build back to profitability.
How about $93,000 a month mortgage is down to about $42,000?
Yeah, that's significant. That's a big deal.
That was huge. And even when it was $90,000+ a month, with all the interest rates, never once did we ever miss a payment. We found a way consistently to make it happen. They brought the Homesteaders program with Teresa, brought together a new life and shined true hope that Verheiden's still here and it will be here. And will it be here when I'm dead and gone? Yeah, no question. But being first generation with the legacy and the history that was entrusted to me from the original 7 owners, no way I can let it down. I envision death this way. We're arguing with the pearly gates of heaven, right? One side of the fence is going to say, you know what? You did a good job. The other side, when you get there, some of the people are going to say, hey, come here. Can I talk to you for a second?
I had some thoughts.
Now, we all make mistakes. And I'm the first one. And the last perfect person was crucified 2,000 years ago. And I don't know how perfect he was. He was kicked out of his own town. But at the end of the day, we're all human. And I use that word human openly because that's part of that motto in our organization. It was the same always to all because we do serve the human race with respect and dignity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the bottom line. As I look at our organization, as we begin to not just have that partnership with Homesteaders and Bancorp, the other vendors that are out there, I mean, that's advice I would say if anybody says, hey, Brian, where do you go from here? You know, I'd probably tell you, first, be the negative Nick in your organization. Be the negative Nick.
Mm-hmm.
What could happen? What plan could you try to avoid? What is your risk management issues? I know what happened now if we had flood number 2. I mean, there's a whole plan that we laid out. Way too much for this conversation. But being that negative Nick, I think, is important. Understanding the basics of your business principles. Is sometimes people joke and say, oh, the SWOT program is so old and so forth. But you know what? Your strengths, your weaknesses, your opportunities, and your threats are the same. When you look back what we did in 1988, 89, 1985, 1990, 2000, you know what? Those bullet points sometimes are still there and sometimes they change. But you should be cognizant enough of your operation, of what is changing. Because when you get deeper into that, the relationships with vendors are extremely important to know that those vendors in the industry are also looking out for your best interest. And it goes this way, and I'll say this to you. My grandfather said to me, who was sidebar, He was one of the last survivors of the Titanic. He said that that's why behind my shoulder, you'll see that picture of the Titanic back there. That's one of the newspapers, original newspapers. But he said, believe nothing what people tell you, half of what you see, until somebody's willing to prove it. But they're not proving it to you. It's you yourself that have to prove it based on your own behaviors and actions. The behaviors and actions of the vendors that help us, that truly prove it to themselves that we are an important piece of their operation, that's key.
Yeah, I think it's true in so many facets of life that you are as successful as the people who you surround yourself with. Correct. That like who you allow to influence you and support you really matters. And I think that's true of funeral businesses too, and the partners and the vendors that they're using, the people that they're entrusting, you know, their brand and their service model to, those relationships are really important and have to be considered really carefully. You have such a beautiful story to tell, and I've appreciated hearing about it every single time I've been able to hear you talk about it. I learned something new about you and your story and your funeral business. And I'm hoping that's true of our podcast listeners too, but I know we are about out of time. So I want to wrap up with the two questions we ask of every single podcast guest. Sure. On Calling Hours. So the first one is, what are you reading right now?
I'm reading two books. One book is called Jesus CEO. It's about visionary leadership. And I've had that book for 20 years. It's only a chapter a day, and I've read it and continue to read it every year.
Oh, you read it every, so you've reread
every, it. I continue to reread it, because when you begin to look at the visionary leadership of it all, and I'll save that part of it if you ever get it. I'll get you a copy of it. It's only a 1 or 2 page a day book, because it helps you to reflect on visionary leadership. The other book I read is The Discipline of Destiny. It's about the power of your self-control, how much control you can, personal part of it. So,
Discipline of Destiny. I've not heard that one. That's an interesting one. It's always selfish for me, because I love good book recommendations. So I collect them from this podcast and use them for my own personal use. And hopefully the listeners enjoy that part too. But honestly, I don't care if they do or not. The last question we ask of every podcast guest is, what is giving you energy right now?
Our team, my faith, the ability to provide freedom to so many, and expanding the legacy by helping other funeral homes that need a succession plan or just to grow their business. Because it goes back to what my grandfather said, help enough other people get where they need to be in life, and then you yourself have nothing to worry about.
That's an incredible answer. I usually hear coffee or their favorite candy bar. That is a remarkably thoughtful answer. And of course,
well, you like Butterfingers, so.
I will remember that. Well, Brian, thank you so much for your time and for your story and just the beautiful way that you have managed your business and served families and managed your team. You are a remarkable person and a remarkable funeral home owner. And I feel very grateful and blessed to know you.
Well, thank you, Danielle. Appreciate that.